The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney in Singapore, I should say. David, we've got you on the cell phone. Tell everyone who's listening why you're in Singapore right now and why they should be interested.
Well, for me, it's a point of curiosity. We have to know and we have to try to figure out as best we can what is taking place in this part of the world, Asia in general, but China in particular, and what is changing? What does it mean if there is a successful transition to a different form of growth in China? And how does that impact your major trade partners in this region and throughout the world? One of the projects that we've been on now for several weeks or several months is the second installment of our DVD. And this is one that looks specifically at China and Asia. We've called it Asian Ascendance. And it's still probably 6 weeks out from being finished. But this is a part of our research, boots on the ground, to look the economists straight in the eye, to look at the leaders of thought straight in the eye and have some frank discussions. What's working? What's not working? What are your greatest challenges ahead? And so it's interesting because Singapore in particular is a little bit like Switzerland in Europe. It's an enclave. It's out of the way. It's neutral. They are no one's friend, no one's enemy. They kind of mind their own business and mind their business well, they do. So it's a place that has become a regional banking center and competes vigorously with Hong Kong, which is sort of an extension of mainland China, just a business depot, if you will. But it competes with Hong Kong as one of the primary financial centers in Asia. Singapore is, in that regard, running neck and neck with Hong Kong. There's probably a few more money managers in Hong Kong and a lot more smog. So you do find some very interesting companies and stories here in this place.
Well, and David, you know, talking about Asia, this is something that we've been watching from a gold perspective now for the last decade. It's really not American buying that's causing gold to go up. It's maybe not even that much in European buying, but it's the Asian buying. And, you know, since 2008, Asia's been acquiring hard assets as well as energy assets just voraciously, have they not?
They absolutely have. And even when they take a break, they get right back to it fairly quickly. I'll give an example. We went to Little India, which is a small little enclave here in Singapore, for dinner the other night. And after having a delicious Indian meal, we're walking around the streets. And, you know, we're right at the end of the Ramadan fast. And there's only two retail outlets that are open, restaurants and gold shops. And there are so many gold shops up and down these Indian streets. Everything else is closed. And on the outside of the storefront, they're giving their revised hours given still the celebration of Ramadan. So, you know, it's this notion that when we finish the fast, there's two things that we want to do. We'd like to eat. And by the way, we're celebrating. We'd like to celebrate in the way that they have traditionally. And this is one of the reasons why there is some seasonality to the gold price. We've always seen, I shouldn't say always, that's hyperbolic, but at least 20 out of the last 21 years, we have seen the price of gold recover nicely towards the end of summer and in the beginning of fall for two primary reasons. One, the end of Ramadan, and two, the beginning of the Indian wedding season, both traditional periods where these two people groups are very interested in owning, and they do own and add to what they own significantly, that is specifically gold.
Well, and David, I saw a statistic just the other day that was amazing to me, that China in the last 3 months has purchased more gold than all of England's holdings. Okay, now England was the empire for 1,000 years. Okay, and when you go to London, you realize that a lot of that empire was built on gold. Okay, at some points it was Spanish gold, at other points it was gold from around the world, you know, the five continents that they occupied. But what's interesting at this point is China is buying enough gold right now to overwhelm all the reserves in England, and that just occurred over the last quarter. So it's hard to put in perspective from this side of the Atlantic just how much there's interest in things that are going to be real, things that are going to be tangible, and actually going to the energy side of things, things that will run industry and produce from, you know, from this point forward.
Well, you know, there's a number of things to say there, because obviously China's oil ambitions are fairly intense. With CNOOC buying a Canadian company, it's one of the largest acquisitions they've made since their failed bid for Unocal. You know, and this is a $17.9 to $18.2 billion deal that's being done. Again, to rival Unocal, unfortunately, they couldn't get that done. But the Canadian government has allowed many of these kinds of acquisitions to go through. In fact, since 2008, China has acquired hard assets aggressively, $40 billion in Canada, $23 billion worth of acquisitions in Australia, and nearly $19 billion in Brazil. So again, this most recent announcement of Chinese, that is CNOOC purchase of Nexen, that's the Canadian company, it's a major move forward for them. And it's a little bit different than their past acquisitions because it's a major move into oil sands. And as far as the Chinese are concerned, higher oil prices are the wave of the future. The reason I say that is because the supply source you're talking about, oil sands, is a very bad bet. It's a very bad bet on any other pricing assumption. If you think oil is going to be sub 60, it's a losing proposition. If you think oil is going to be over 100, then your purchase of oil sands assets is quite profitable. And that's what they're doing at present. I wanted to say one other thing about Singapore before we move on. And it's simply this. As I look at the cityscape, what I see is countless skyscrapers that are being built for residential purpose. We're talking about 20, 30, 40, 50-story buildings that are being put to use primarily as a second residence. You know, what's interesting is the flow of people into this place for second residences. But by the way, the areas of town where these are going up, you can't buy a small little shoebox apartment for less than $500,000 to $1 million, American equivalent.
So, David, what you're saying is you don't go to Singapore necessarily for the bargains.
No, there's no bargains here. But what is compelling is the flow of people who are coming in to buy a second residence. When you want assets someplace else, and when you have a lot of assets that you don't want to necessarily tell anyone about, and I'm specifically talking about the wealthy Chinese, it makes a lot of sense to pay cash for real estate in a place like Singapore. It's a hop, skip, and a jump away. It's a place that you're comfortable with culturally, and it's a place that you can have a banking relationship and maybe even hang a few nice pieces of art in that apartment that is worth $500 to $1 million. So you know, what you see in Singapore is a lot of luxury cars and a lot of luxury residences and a lot of luxury that is non-Singaporean. It is, frankly, mostly Chinese. Granted, there's a cross-section. It truly is a melting pot. Their cuisine is reflective of this being a melting pot. You have influences from Malaysia, influences from India, influences from Indonesia, South Korea, and the whole Asian region. But the primary money flow into this place at present is Chinese wealth. This goes back to what we discussed with several of our interviews in weeks past relating to China, and that is there is a need, and certainly a desire, maybe as much as a need, for money to be outside of the Chinese system. This is officials who are in China who are no longer comfortable with having all of their eggs in one geographic basket. They know that their government may or may not successfully make this transition, and that leaves their wealth, newfound wealth, at jeopardy.
So, David, is it overstating the case that Singapore may be an Asian Switzerland? You know, for hundreds of years, Switzerland has been used as sort of a safe haven. Even from warring enemies, they can keep their assets in Switzerland and know that they're safe. Are you saying Singapore serves to some degree that same purpose for Asian investment or even American investment?
Well, even more so than Costa Rica in Central America, because oftentimes people will talk about Costa Rica as the Switzerland of Latin America or Central America. And while it is to some degree because of its political stability and its strong rule of law, those things are very interesting about Costa Rica, but there is more sophistication, more money, and really a true competition to be one of the financial centers of the world here in Singapore. In the past, we talked about Manhattan or New York, London, and Japan or Tokyo being really significant money centers. And again, going back to my earlier comments, you have Hong Kong and Singapore competing for that Asian space of preeminence.
Well, David, I know even in Singapore, CNBC is going to be interviewing you today, and you're only going to have about 5 minutes to talk about a lot of issues. I know one of the things that they're going to ask you about is the recent rise in grain prices. Now, let's put this in perspective for a moment. If we just go back a little over a year, Egypt was being affected dramatically by inflation in grain prices, enough so that we saw a change in leadership. And then not too long after that, Libya. So we've seen an Arab Spring type of issue, and of course we've got Syria right now. We know that a rise in grain prices has more of an effect on politics sometimes than it does even the financial markets. Now, what are you going to say today in the CNBC interview on grain prices?
Well, Kevin, truly, there is a small number of people who are interested in trading the grain market, or the ags, if you will. It's a pretty small community. And to me, ags or soft commodities are a reasonable bet until it rains, which in this case may be this afternoon. The issue with ag speculation, in my opinion, is that the supply side has many more unknowable elements, and these are what remain the most important component in pricing. I prefer something like gold, frankly, where in terms of an interest in commodities, and certainly we view it as currency as well, prefer a supply-constrained commodity where the primary variable in pricing is demand, and that, I think, we can quantify to a greater degree what would be impacting demand. So in my opinion, you've got something that is less of a speculation and something you can come to a sound understanding of. Now, the interesting thing with ags, as we are all aware, there is a major drought happening in America, and as a consequence, we have high ag prices. That probably means that there's going to be major culling of livestock herds. And as there is culling of livestock herds at a smaller group of pigs and cows and whatnot to be slaughtered next year. So hogs and cattle could be an interesting bet. We're not particularly interested in investing there. But a major move in hogs, you know, again, this is how sort of interconnected these worlds are. Drought in America can mean price inflation in China because hogs, pork, is a main staple within China. So these are things that you have to keep in mind and just remember how small the world actually is. Because as you mentioned, politics is actually one of the most important things in that inflation scenario. And to the degree that you have price inflation in China, you've got folks who are not quite in the middle class, who would like to be and who now can't afford what they thought they would be able to. Yes, that spells discontent, dissatisfaction, even putting the boots on and marching in the street. So it's a real problem. Price inflation has always been a Chinese issue.
Well, David, you know, it's interesting when we talk about inflation, sometimes we think in broad terms that everything's just rising in prices, but we have a strange scenario right now where we have price inflation in the thing the poor people cannot buy but have to have, and that's food. Yet, are we going to have price inflation, say, in the industrial commodities? Because we are experiencing a slowdown right now. Granted, we've got inflation in food prices, and that could be attributed to, like you said, the weather, or it could be attributed to a number of things. But how about industrial metals? How about the hard commodities?
Yeah, this is where I think you see the key distinction between needs and wants. We've got industrial metals that are weaker. You've got copper slipping to one-month lows. You've got nickel, which is at three-year lows. And these are the kinds of things that, you know, go into new development, that go into the things that you may want. If you want a stainless steel refrigerator instead of the old black-covered Maytag, this is the kind of thing that you pay up for, but you don't need it. You want it. And those needs, again, go back to what you were describing. It's the bowl of rice, it's the tortillas, it's the things that are the basic staples around the world, and that's where you see price inflation is very dangerous politically.
David, and what you're talking about with these industrial metals, let's say platinum and copper and some of these types of things, they can have a very different life than a monetary metal like gold. Now, gold's been relatively boring here from a price perspective over the last few months, but could you address the difference of the prospects of the gold market and the prospects of, say, the copper market and how they differ?
Well, I want to give credit where credit is due, and it's not very often that you see a positive article on gold in the Financial Times, but we do have one today, and maybe this is just in the Asian version. I don't know. Someone will have to check this, but John Plender writes that even those on the Panglossian side of the argument should recognize that there is a case for taking out insurance via gold against the alternative scenario. And just to put that in context, earlier in the same article, John is talking about the unlikely event of policies being put in place to address both fiscal deficits and the debt problems that we have in the developed world. And this is the reality. We may come up with the best plans, but it's still going to take political will to put them in place. And so the argument for owning gold, at least in John's words, are that you may need an insurance against this kind of failure to proceed in a positive manner. And, Kevin, that's just the way we've looked at gold. We've always seen gold as an insurance. And this is, I think, one of the things that's interesting, because I think precious metals are a great bet, given that buying systematic insurance is not only in vogue today in Europe, and specifically what I'm talking about is you consider Spanish credit default spread. They're about 600 basis points today, and they were 100 basis points a few years ago. And again, Spanish credit default swaps, any credit default swaps, this is just a means of protecting against default on paper that you may own. If you own Spanish bonds, you can turn around and buy CDS or credit default spreads, credit default swaps, and cover that credit risk by paying a small insurance, if you will, for that. The insurance costs have gone up manyfold there in Spain, but it's really likely to be even more popular globally as Western politicians largely ignore the imbalances that exist today in the global economy. So we're really not talking about just Spanish concern or the need to insure against Spanish default, but we're talking about a need to insure against default on a larger, more systemic basis. And this is really where monetary policies only serve to intensify the flow of investors into metals seeking to protect assets in a low to negative real rate environment. Kevin, as you recall, we've talked about being in a negative real rate environment or even just a low real rate environment. And that's one reason why investors flock to metals. But as people are concerned about what their money purchases or concerned about the credit quality of the country that they live in, and they can no longer consider the sovereign paper of that country the best place to store their assets, then gold becomes, again, that natural insurance, that natural lifeboat. Yeah, but that's what we've seen over the last 10 years, is a gradual shift in the audience from just a few mavericks thinking that it made sense to have insurance to now some really, really concerned people who are frankly middle of the road in terms of their political or economic concerns, but somewhere deep in their gut, they're still feeling like something's not going to be fixed, or if it is fixed, it's not going to be fixed easily or without pain. And those are folks that 10 years ago would not have been interested in owning gold, but today do own it as an insurance policy.
Well, and you know, David, on our website where this show is found, listeners can click and see just a beautiful chart showing this last 10 years that you're talking about. And there's a repeating pattern that started, you know, right in the middle of 2001 that this chart shows. You know, gold went up about 66%, and, you know, it had started below $300 an ounce, went up 66%, and then after hitting a new high, leveled out 15 months. It was like a step. And then it went up 73% to a new high. And then it came down and leveled out for about 15 months. It's like taking a breath in the market. And then it went up 56%, hit a new high, came down, leveled off, took a breath. And then this last move from 2009 till about 2011, we went on up past 1900 briefly. And now it's come down. It's taking a breath in the mid $1,500 to $1,600 range. But all of those breaths, David, those steps, and this can be seen in the chart, last between 15 and 16 months, and then gold goes on and makes a new high. Now, this is in an environment that has had no hyperinflation in it. This is not a bubble environment. This is just what you're talking about, a low real rate of return environment and a low faith environment in the paper markets. And we're seeing that in the steady rise of gold. David, would you address the moving average and just how that's so important to look at versus the daily prices?
Well, the conversations that I've had in recent weeks, whether it's in Las Vegas or in Zurich, Switzerland, Geneva, where I was at just a few weeks ago, or even here in Singapore, it's as if people are expecting there to be a catalyst to take gold to a higher level. And I'm wondering, as I look back over the last 10 years, what the catalyst was in 2002, what the catalyst was in 2003 and 4, what the catalyst was as we took off again in 2006, what the catalyst was at the end of 2007 into 2008, what the catalyst was. I could bore you with this, but the reality is there has been no catalyst. What you've had is a gradual migration of investors who are putting the pieces together and realizing that we have political issues which have to be addressed, economic and fiscal issues which have to be addressed. And I don't know that we have the right people in place to get that done. And frankly, that's not a question of changing from one party to the other, from the red shirts to blue shirts, as it were, here in the United States. We've had a series of elections around the world, and the proof is still needing to be put on the table. We don't know yet if we have the resolve in any of these countries, the leadership to say, I'm going to do the right thing. Ironically, Kevin, ironically, there is leadership that today in Italy has a good shot at putting in stabilizing reforms. Mario Monti is not the country bumpkin that some would like to think that he is. In fact, one of his favorite authors is, have any guesses?
Well, I hope it's not John Maynard Keynes like most of those guys.
That's a reasonable guess. That's an educated guess. But Friedrich Hayek is one of his favorite authors. And this is telling to me, Kevin. It's telling to me because there is a different set of ideas that is going to be present amongst the decision makers that will actually turn this around. Ultimately, that's very positive. But we're talking about one person in leadership today out of one country in Europe. Meanwhile, the French bring in François Hollande.
Yeah, that's just pure socialism, Dave.
Beyond pure socialism, Kevin, it's national suicide. I mean, I don't think you understand what the importance of that election was. What may actually tip the scale in terms of European stability has nothing to do with Spain or Italy, because yes, they have their problems, but they may theoretically be solvable. Greeks, sorry, they're not solvable. They're going the way of the dodo bird to some degree. But this is an issue. France and Germany were the linchpin of the whole Euro project. And now you've got someone who's willing to play chicken with the whole project for France's benefit and a very socialist agenda. And that's quite dangerous. That's quite dangerous to global financial stability. You'd probably be heralded as a hero, at least in the streets of Paris.
Well, David, and that's just talking about Europe. And yeah, Europe's a mess. We're all sick of hearing about Europe, I have to say. But I've got clients who are calling in and saying, yes, but what if we have a political change? What if we have a change in Washington? And I've got to say, if our listeners would just look at this chart, it's amazing. Two-thirds of this chart from 2001 through 2012, it's a rising, steady rise of gold, not even a blip when we switched from Bush to Obama. And so my thought would be, we're probably not going to have a blip if we switch from Obama to Romney. I mean, what's your thought on the effect of new change in leadership, if we get it in Washington, on the currently rising gold bull market?
The democratic system that we have in place today is one that is, frankly, compromised. It doesn't allow for a politician to do what they should do. They're always at the beck and call of the 51%. Talked about the 1%, we've talked about the 99%. This is the way the haves and have-nots are being cast in the popular mind today. But the real problem is not the 1 or the 99, it's the 51. And the 51 is what makes real political change and doing anything right unreasonable, because most of the people who are going into political office have the resources to get into office. And frankly, if they're going to spend the money to be there, they're going to stay as long as they possibly can and reap as much reward from it as they possibly can. That has become the nature of politics in America. So we're talking about a different environment altogether, where you're attracting not people who are in it for themselves. And frankly, I can't imagine who would want to run for president. Honestly, I can't. You look at Romney, and I'd say this is probably sort of a Bain capital, vulture capital kind of approach to what he can do to reorganize this country. Do we need reorganization? Yes. But frankly, I don't want it to be to the benefit of the Romney family. That I find appalling. No, what I do find equally appalling is that we have the same kind of aspiration, less spoken, less obvious. But if you look at the balance sheet of Senior Obama, you will see that his balance sheet has grown considerably since he came into Senate and then now in the White House. How is that possible? How is someone who makes a low six-digit salary as a paid official rising in the ranks of the American wealthy? This is what we talked about a few weeks ago in terms of Chinese crime and politics. This is what we talked about, also is looking at our deficit in the United States. We have roughly 8 to 10% of our economy, which goes to political graft. This is spending, which we cannot afford. Politicians have put us on the hook for it, and this is the way they have bought their vote. They've bought their vote, plain and simple, and they cannot cut the budget. So when we look at fiscal issues, when we look at debt issues, and it seems plain to you or to me or to any of our listeners that it's real simple, you just have to stop spending as much and maybe save a little bit more. The problem is they are a part of a system which is today corrupted. The kind of democracy that we have today has too much political graft and theft in it, and to change it will take nothing short of a revolution.
And so, David, what we're saying, okay, whether it's China or whether it's Europe, whether it's America, right now the best bet is to get out of the system that is represented by unpayable debt and get into something physical that actually maintains value until they play this thing out, whether we have a political change in Washington, partisan change in Washington or not. The debt system is not going to be solved with the current solutions that either party's offering. That's what I think I hear you saying.
Well, your alternative is that you can just go through the meat grinder. And that's, again, you don't see catalysts driving the gold market. You see a gradual migration of people who are waking up to the fact that debt is a killer to our economy. And we have too much of it. And there's no way that our economy can recover under the full weight of the debt and obligations that we have. And so the question for the average investor is, do I want to go through the meat grinder or not? And that's why people look at gold differently today than they did 2 years ago, 3 years ago, or 10 years ago, because we weren't in the process of being grist for the mill 10 years ago. And we are today. And we have become so even more with every passing day since the year 2000. So this is really the crux of it. The audience is growing. It's a global audience. We've talked about that in the past. The fact that Asia and the Indian subcontinent represent the lion's share of gold ownership means that Americans will come late to this market. It means that Western Europeans will come late to this market. And the benefits received by being early, so the Mavericks who bought in 2002 and 3 and 4 and 5 and 6 and 7 and 8 and 9, they will continue to benefit. And the ones who come in late will benefit only marginally. But I think this is, again, where you talk about the 65-week moving average. What you see here is a very stable story. And it is one of investor migration for a very good reason. And again, it comes back to something very simple. We will see a political nightmare. So with the steady progress, there has been corrective phases every year or two. And they have lasted, on average, 15, 16. The last one lasted 19 months. So we have seen these corrections before. We've seen these consolidations before in the larger context. And immediately following those corrective phases, what happened? Where did the price go?
Well, David, that's the interesting thing. The price, once it finished the consolidation, went on up to a new high. Now, we have gone about 11 months into this consolidation. It's been about 11 months, roughly, since we see gold above $1,900. Now, my question to you would be this. This consolidation, is this buying high, or is it like the last three consolidations that anyone who buys in this region actually buys gold at the lowest price that we'll probably see in this bull market?
Well, I think you have to answer affirmative on both of those. Buying at 1500 is a lot higher than 250, 350, 450, 550, 650, but it's also the lowest point you could be at in a period of consolidation. And that if you, instead of choosing the lowest point in every period of consolidation, picked the new high that had recently been set, you'd be talking about 375, you'd be talking about 435, you'd be talking about 720, you'd be talking about just over $1,000, you'd be talking about 1250, you'd be talking about 1920. These are all of the highs. And as you look back retrospectively, or what you'll find is that there's only one that you don't like, 1920. And I would just say, give it a little bit of time before it too is left behind and is a number that anyone would be happy owning gold at relative to the current price. Are we bullish on gold? I think unabashedly we're bullish on gold, but that's partially because we're somewhat pessimistic about the political strength that we see in the United States and globally. People who, number one, don't get the issues, and people who, number two, are constrained by the environment they're in, a political system which will chew them up and spit them out if they were to even attempt to do the right thing. And unfortunately, Kevin, this is why the book that we read so many months ago, The Fourth Turning, becomes so important, because it is at this stage in history, after basically 100 years of consistent and steady growth, that we have to see a major disruption. And this is, again, Neil Strauss and William Howe's take was that every 100 to 120 years, you go through a cycle, and this full cycle
And David, this full cycle is very similar to a lifetime. I mean, first you're born, you have the growth phase, then you have the teen and 20 years, and then you start to mature and have the middle age growing into old age. And then finally you have old age, and the cycle recycles itself. And you know what these guys were talking about, if you were to just take the last cycle into account, the 1950s were that early teen stage, that exciting growth stage, and then of course we start to have the wake-up call in our 20s and 30s, and then in our 40s, 50s, and 60s there's disillusionment, and then finally the end is usually cyclically a crisis of some sort of death, metaphorically, you know, with a lifetime, but in this case it's economically and politically. And we've seen that cycle over and over. According to this book, we've seen that cycle at least for the last 500 years. And so what you're talking about is some sort of death of this debt cycle.
I can't recommend the book highly enough. To put in perspective 600 years of British and American history and see that there is a pattern to periods of renewal and regeneration spiritually and socially, and that these things happen consistently after major crises. And these crises bring about an incredible resolve amongst a new generation that has gone through the crisis and appreciates just what pain looks like and feels like and the kind of commitment they're going to need so that this kind of thing never happens again. Remember that the greatest generation was not the greatest generation prior to the war. They were considered the greatest generation after coming through the war, and they set the standard for growth and development and what we know as the American dream today, but that's something that I think we've become very complacent with, which is a hallmark of the fourth turning and leads into the fourth turning, complacency. And ultimately, there's an accident that happens, and those kinds of accidents, again, can lead you to international conflict, which is what Strauss and Howe talk about, or even civil war, like we've seen in the United States, or frankly, in other parts of the world, too. But consistently, there is conflict because there is a battle for ideas in play in that fourth turning. And ultimately, the first turning, or that first season of renewal, is one that's actually pretty exciting. And I think, Kevin, that that's something that even if things should get worse from here, we have a lot to look forward to that's quite positive.
Well, and for those people who do go through those fourth turnings, the ones who come out somewhat intact are the ones who saw it coming and took appropriate preparation.
Kevin, when we look at the global macro thematics of our day, whether it is concerns for the devolution in Europe or the ascendancy in Asia or the stagnation in America as a result of too much debt and not enough income to pay it, consistently what we have in the mix is change. And people need to be very open-minded to what that means for them. Our encouragement is that you just organize your resources so that whatever change looks like in our times, you have all your options open. Keep all your options open.
Well, you've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. Or you can give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.